In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I are going to be talking about whether or not startup validation works. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 142. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So word this week, Mike.
Well, I got an email from Kissmetrics regarding an app they developed called My Analytics, and it allows you to take a look at all of your Google Analytics data on your iPhone. Have you seen this yet?
I saw the app. I had an early beta version of that, and it was pretty stripped down at the time. It looked cool, but it didn't do much. Is it pretty cool?
I mean, it's probably pretty similar to what you saw. I mean, it does allow you to see at least the basics and stuff. But what I liked was it allows you to go back and compare some of your data from like yesterday or this past or the current week against previous data points that they kind of hard code in. So you don't have a lot of options in terms of saying, well, I want to compare 3 days ago versus, 14 days ago or something like that. There, some of those data points are just hard coded in. So you've got options for yesterday, this week, and then you can go back either 1 week or 2 weeks, etc. But you can't just do like a date range or something like that and compare those. But it does allow you to do at least some minimal comparisons and pull the data right up on your iPhone, which, I didn't have a way to do that before.
Yeah, it looks really nice. The screenshots look nice. And it's free. There's no fee to use it. Very cool. We got an email from Dominic Patmore, and he's at pilifter.com. That's pilifter.com. He says, I've been listening to Startups for the Rest of Us since December. It's comforting to know I'm not the only one seeking to create and maintain small businesses. I wanted to say that your advice helped me help another entrepreneur from making a common mistake. I met with him yesterday, and he was explaining his mobile app, which he felt was heading to version 2.0, and his aim was to get to venture funding and get bought out. However, when I asked him how many users he had, he said zero, but said he had a number of interviewees who would be willing to pay him. And then he gets to, how we become involved. He says, hearing your voice in my head, I told him that the best thing would be to go back to those users and get them to pony up on a beta release. My reasoning was that if they've so loved the idea, what would they pay to see it go to version 2, 3, or 4? If there's no one, then maybe it'd be better to go back to see if the solution is actually addressing a real need. This was in a tech hub space, I think like a co-working space. And there was another developer next to us that jumped in to confirm what I'd said. Thanks to you, hopefully, I was able to steer someone away from putting more money into building something for no audience. Thanks again, and keep up the great work. So thanks for writing in, Dominic. I love hearing stories. It's kind of like second generation. We didn't directly help someone, but it's like an indirect relationship.
Very cool.
Yeah, the only other thing is Drip continues to move along. I have 11 early access customers. There are 8 or 9 of them that are actually active. It's getting to the point where we have enough people in there that it's hard to tell what everyone's doing now. But we're moving forward and keep getting emails about people wanting to use it. So that's good validation for me. And then we did push a big feature live today that's going to help with onboarding. And it basically allows people to easily create. It does something no other email app does. It allows you to like do one click and have this whole template for an email sequence spit out. And then you just kind of fill in the blanks. It's a neat feature and it's finally out. And then we're working on split testing next, which is really the last major feature we're going to implement before launching to the world. So we're about a month out. Every week the early access users grow, and so I'm excited to move forward.
That's cool. It's great to hear that you're moving forward. Personally, for AutoShark, I feel like I'm moving backwards because things are just going sideways.
Is that right? What's the problem?
It's not even just one thing. Like if it was just one thing, I could deal with it. Maybe 2 or 3, it would be all right. But it just seems like there's all these different things that are moving in different directions all at once right now. And like it just feels like nothing is going right. For example, like the automated upgrade path for all the different things that I had in place that used to be working. Now things are just not working for whatever reason. So whenever I go to do a deployment, basically the entire system stops functioning. And then I had a system of sending emails so that when audits would run, you'd get emails from them. That's not working anymore. It's hard to get to the bottom of all of it because there's so many different, I'll call them dependencies for lack of a better way to put it. But all these different things that I didn't necessarily write that I don't fully understand how they work. So debugging them and troubleshooting them just takes forever.
Yeah, that's a real bummer. So it's stuff that developers who are still working for you wrote, or is it past developers?
Well, some of it's libraries. So for example, there's a scheduler library that was supposed to run things on a scheduled basis. And when it fails, I don't really get any feedback about why it's failing or whether or not it's continuing to run and it's just like throwing exceptions in the middle of it. So I still have to dig into it and try and figure out what's going on. But like I said, it's all these different moving parts. They're all in the air, and trying to figure them out is taxing, to say the least.
Yeah, well, and the bummer is you're like, you're in early access, and so you're trying to manage that process as well as this technical side.
Right.
And I mean, it underscores how many things you have to juggle as a software entrepreneur that you wouldn't have to juggle if you were launching, say, an information product or just a new blog or, you know, something that relies more on content. You're not going to tend to hit all these snags that we do because software is very complex.
Right. This week's episode is kind of inspired by a blog post that Dan Norris wrote about whether startup validation is legitimate or not. You know, he's got some issues with Eric Ries's book called The Lean Startup. And, you know, you look at the startup community and it generally, and I'm kind of paraphrasing and overgeneralizing here, but the startup community generally says, if you read this book and do what it says, you're generally going to be successful. But there's a lot of startups out there who've tried this approach and just failed miserably. And the question is, does that mean it doesn't work? And Dan's got a pretty lengthy blog article on where he's basically calling it out and saying, you know, this stuff, I've tried this and I tried this and I tried this, and this stuff just doesn't work.
Right. He gives a bunch of numbers, how he sent out surveys, and he gives you exact percentages, shows the press coverage that he got, and talks through how many people he got to sign up for a launch list and all that. So it's a nice in-depth piece. We'll obviously link it up in the show notes, but the title is Startup Validation BS? So we wanted to kind of talk through those. I have to be honest, my views on the whole lean thing are constantly evolving. I'm still critical of people in a movement who are doing a lot of teaching, but they're not launching startups. You know, in any field, there's academics who are studying and researching. And then there are kind of people on the ground who are actually doing, and there needs to be collaboration between those two sides. But the startup space has never really been that way. Academics have always tended to be behind, like the MBA programs tend to be behind where the actual founders are. Now, maybe the lean startup movement is a diverging of that, and we are going to fit the models that, you know, psychology and medicine, computer science, you know, those fields have fit for years, but it's still a challenge to feel like someone with their feet on the ground who knows the tactics that work and the ones that don't work, to kind of hear this movement that I definitely think has positive points, but to hear some people take it on as like the, you know, the gospel or the way to do it, and that if you do this, you'll be successful, if you don't do this, you'll fail type thing. That's where I say, like, my views on lean are evolving. I'm not pro lean or against lean. I love some of the tenets of it, and I think other parts of it are questionable, and I don't do them in my own startups.
I think one of the things that comes up in my mind is that there are a lot of these classic mistakes that you can make when launching a product that have absolutely nothing to do with startup validation. And although you've gone through the process of validating your ideas, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're still doing the right things. Back in episode 121, we talked about 7 catastrophically common launch mistakes. And you go through that list and you look at those, and even if you've validated your startup idea, if you start going through and you commit all of these launch mistakes, it doesn't mean you're going to be successful with your product. I mean, it's very difficult to be successful when you're shooting your foot every time you try to take a step.
If you think about building a successful product as kind of this triangle or this three-legged stool, and you need product as one of the legs, you need market as another, and you need execution as the third. And so you can build an amazing product, but if it doesn't actually solve a problem that anyone needs, you're going to fail, period. You know, if you use Lean Startup or use another method to validate it up front, then hopefully you have found a problem that actually needs solving. And then you actually need to find a market that you can market to. So that's the second part of it. Then you need to actually execute well. And in other words, don't make the common startup, you know, launch mistakes, execution mistakes, marketing mistakes. So there's a lot of elements that go into it that validation just says, hopefully it says, you know, you have a good chance of people actually wanting this problem solved. And hopefully the solution that you're looking at is going to solve it. But that's how I view it. I don't think you can get to a point of even 99% certainty just by doing pre-validation. I think it gets you more, you know, it gets you above the 5% certainty we used to get to. Maybe it gets you to 60 or 70% that if you execute really well, both on both the product and the marketing side, don't make a bunch of common mistakes, that then you have a pretty good chance of success.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just points out the fact that there are no guarantees. And that's really what it boils down to, is that even if you do all the right things, that you're not necessarily going to be successful. You know, there's always this asteroid that could come out of left field and blow your startup away. But even accepting that, you can go through this process, try to validate your ideas, and then still fail at it because just not enough people are interested in buying whatever it is that you have to offer. So one of the things that I wanted to point out was that even assuming that you have a very large mailing list, you know, that's kind of a classic assumption, is that if you get a large mailing list, you're going to launch and you're going to get lots of customers very, very quickly. And I don't believe that's the case. I mean, if you have 4,000 people on a mailing list, if you have a 1% conversion rate, that'll get you 40 customers, or, you know, 20 customers at a 0.5% conversion rate. And I think that's not true. I mean, there's some fallacies associated with trying to assume that having a large mailing list is going to equate to a large number of customers. And part of that is because of your conversion process. You have to be putting in good calls to action. You have to be telling them exactly what it is that you're offering, why it solves their problem, how it solves their problem, how much money it's going to save them, how much it's going to be worth to them. You can't just blast this out there to a giant mailing list and expect that all of these people are going to buy your product on day one, even if they said they would originally. You really have to educate them about what the product is going to do for them and how it is going to benefit them. You know, just blasting out these emails is not enough.
I don't think Dan, you know, I don't think he just sent out kind of a random email and said, hey, buy the product. I don't recall if I was on the launch list for his original product, which is called Informly, but he's a good content marketer, you know, and he's a good copywriter, and he executes pretty well on this stuff. So I wish I knew a little more in depth. That's actually one thing. His post, I like the way he formed it. I like the way he gives a lot of data, but he doesn't really talk about what he did to turn people into paying customers. So some questions that come into my head are, did he launch with a single launch email? You know, did he build up this list of 1,000 or 2,000 people and then just send them a list and say, hey, here's the product, here are the benefits, come and check it out? Or did he do a long sequence? You know, I typically do a 4-email sequence during launch. I also typically email every between 6 and 12 weeks. If, you know, if you're working on a product for 8 months, I would probably touch base with them every couple of months during that time with progress updates to build anticipation and to actually see the response from that. If no one emails you back, then it's kind of not a dead list, but it's people who are not really interested in what you have. But if you get 20 responses of people saying, wow, this looks fantastic, can't wait to get in, then that's a whole other story, right? I think the other thing that comes to mind is that Dan has a decent personal brand. So he has a podcast and email newsletter, 5,500 people. He just has a lot going on. So I've found that signups from my personal brand audience don't typically result in trials or sales of my software. I mean, Mike, we have the podcast, I have the blog, we have MicroConf, we have Micropreneur Academy, all of that huge footprint, and it is a pretty sizable footprint. I would say I have tens of Hittail customers out of, you know, there are four figures of Hittail paying customers, and I have literally in the tens. I don't even think there are 100 people from my personal brand audience who signed up. So if Dan's list was seeded with a lot of people from his own audience and not from that exact, you know, target audience who would actually need this, then that could have been another issue with having, because he had a reasonable size list. I think it was 1,000. Actually, that's another question. He mentioned that he has a 1,000 person beta list and then a 1,200 person launch list. Do you know what that means? Because I've never separated those two. I think that you should all have them as one 2,200 person list, and then you should pick out a handful of beta testers from that who can run through it, and everyone else is, you know, just given basically the early bird kind of pre-launch discount to come use the app.
I think that what he meant by that is that he had 1,000 people sign up for the beta over the course of 3 months and go through it, and then there were another 1,200 people that entered their email address to be notified of the launch. I mean, I'm kind of in your boat. I'm not real clear what he meant by that, but I got the impression that he kept two separate lists, and he drew the line in the sand at some point and said, okay, everyone before this point is going to be a member of the beta. Everyone after this point is going to be notified of when the launch actually happens.
Got it. That makes a lot more sense. So that would be something I would have done differently then. I'm presuming that during the beta, perhaps it was free, or he had a free plan or something like that. And that's one of the catastrophically common mistakes we talked about. He did mention a free plan in the post, and that only, you know, that he had 4,000 free users and only 15 converted to paid. And that's the problem with free plans, is you give people an alternative. So even if they need their problem solved, if you give them a kind of a way to half solve it, then they will tend to not want to pay for it.
One of the things that Dan points out is that he went through and did some customer development and started asking people questions about surveys. And one of the things that strikes me is that when you're listening to people who aren't paying you money, it's not going to get you anywhere, because nobody wants to hurt your feelings about what your product is. And everyone's going to tell you, oh, this is a great idea, I would pay for that. But the fact is, until you ask them for money, there's this barrier to entry. And if they're willing to give you the money, then you're probably going in the right direction. But if they're not willing to cut you a check or give you a credit card, then you're probably on the wrong track, or you're talking to the wrong person. And my inclination tends to be that you're probably talking to the wrong person, as opposed to you're on the wrong track with it. Because you can usually talk to those people and say, well, if you're not willing to give me a credit card, why is it that you're not willing to? And it could very well be that, well, it's really not that big a pain point for them. And that's the hurdle you have to overcome. If you can't overcome that hurdle, then, you know, make sure that you are, or you're talking to the wrong person. And you need to figure out how you get to talking to those right people, because until you do, you're not going to really find out what their pain point is. You're talking to people who may have a ancillary pain point, but it's not the one you're trying to solve. And, you know, your marketing messages are going to get confused. You're talking to the wrong people, and you're never going to get anywhere when you do that.
I don't think I feel as strongly as you do about having people pay you money up front. I mean, if you look at what we've both done, you know, with Drip and AutoChark, I have a list put together of emails, and I've talked to people about the potential price of what that might be. And I've shown them the potential features and the potential value proposition. And there's a lot of enthusiasm, and there are people wanting to get into the early access. And when I mentioned, you know, the price that will be after the trial, some people have said, oh, that's too expensive. And then, you know, let them go, basically say, yeah, that's fine, I'm not a good fit. But others, you know, they haven't written me a check yet, and they haven't, you know, put their credit card number into the app yet. But I don't think you need to go that far. I think in an ideal world, you would, but I just don't think that's feasible when you're doing kind of a larger launch like this, and you're trying to get thousands of people on a list. I think the best practice that I would lean towards, maybe with, you know, the way I look at it is that first, those first 10 customers, kind of the people that I interviewed and got on a list in order to validate the idea enough to start coding, those people I would consider saying, all right, would you send me a check, or would you give me a credit card number?
I totally agree with all of that. But what I mean by listening to people is that if you're asking them questions like, well, what would make you pay for this? And they say, well, if you built, you know, feature X, and then you go off and you build it for them, then they say, okay, well, you know, now I'll give you a credit card. And you've solved that particular problem for them, but you haven't necessarily solved a problem that is the same for a lot of different people. And really what I meant by, you know, trying to figure out who's paying you money versus who isn't, is when you start listening to the people who aren't paying you money and you listen to too many of them, then you're not necessarily solving any one person's problem or a group of people who all have the same problem. You're solving these individual problems for different people, and you're not necessarily solving the same problem for lots of different people.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And that's where that problem solution fit and then product market fit need to be in sequence. Because if you try to go sell to a bunch of people before you've solved a major pain point that people are willing to pay for, you're doing things out of order and you get scattered. As far as I know, Dan's not a developer, so I think he was outsourcing development. You just can't move fast enough unless you have a whole team of people. You can't move fast enough to hit multiple markets and solve multiple problems at once. And so that could potentially be something that impacted him here.
I think we've talked a little bit before about asking for credit card numbers up front, and I just kind of want to emphasize the point a little bit. It's really more of a, I'll call it more of a psychological barrier than anything else, because when you're trying to convert people from like a free plan into a paid plan, or you're trying to convince them that after signing up for the product, that's when they should give you the credit card after like a 14 or 30 day trial or something like that. Basically, what you're doing is you're putting another artificial barrier in there for them to continue using the product. And really, this is a big mistake. And the reason why, like I said, is rooted more in psychology. And I'll use an analogy here. If you look at enrollment plans for 401k plans, you'll find that the participation rate is commonly more than 90% where automatic enrollment is used. And that's very synonymous with asking for a credit card up front. If you look at companies where they only have, where it's the opposite, where you have to actively try to enroll in it, you have to go to the HR department and say, hey, I'd like to sign up for this, the enrollment after 6 months is more like, I think the statistic is 26% to 43% after 6 months. And that's a huge difference. I mean, that's almost four times the difference between them. So what you're really doing here is you're trying to give the user value and show them the benefits and not have them do anything extra to maintain those benefits. Your software shouldn't be any different. Stop asking them if it's okay for them to continue receiving the benefits of your software. They've already made the decision to sign up, so put that in as part of the barrier to making that decision and couple them together so they don't have to make another one down the road.
Yeah, I think that's a part of execution, and I think it's not the only way you can do it, but it's definitely the rule of thumb that when I'm in doubt, ask for credit card up front. I think another thing, as I was looking through Dan's blog post, I saw, I think it might have pivoted too soon. It looks like Informally was launched, maybe it was 6 weeks before he pivoted into something. And as I thought back, I realized, you know, when I acquired Hittail after I relaunched it, it already solved a problem. And it took me 5 months, even with the marketing knowledge that I have, it took me 5 months to really learn how to market and how to find the people that really needed this product. And that doesn't even include the problem solution portion. So while I don't think it's going to take 5 months for everyone, I was willing to be in it 5 months full time. And that's what I was focused on, aside from some, there was, you know, a couple other smaller tasks I was doing. But in general, it was pretty much 5 months full time of my time to really get Hittail where it started to scale. It was growing slowly during that time. But if you expect something to take off fast in 6 weeks and you have a free plan and you're not asking for credit card up front and you're not forcing people to make a decision and you're not trying to convert them into a paying customer, then it's likely that even if you have built something good or almost good enough that you're not going to convert people. I actually have someone, a friend of mine who's in a mastermind group, and he said, he wrote me an email. He said, I tried the content marketing version of Informally, and the product itself was pretty rough. So meaning that the product execution wasn't where it needed to be for this person to pay. And then he said, there was zero effort made to convert me into a paying customer. I didn't get any emails. I didn't get calls to actions. There was no credit card up front. Basically, it was, you know, some classic mistakes that we see in the startup space. So again, the point of this podcast is not to sit here and point out all the things Dan did wrong, because that's not that helpful. I think what we're trying to say is, in light of whether startup validation works or not, it's a really hard question to answer. But it's keeping in mind that it's not just about validating an idea. It's about the validation really talks about the product, right? About does it solve someone's problem? Everything else, the marketing and then the actual execution is another thing entirely. And if you don't execute really well in that stuff, then you can have all the validation in the world, but the product itself still might not work. It may work, but it may not work as fast as you want it.
We've mentioned this in the past, but it was the long, slow SaaS ramp of death from the CEO of Constant Contact. She spoke at the Businesses Software Conference this past year. And that's just accurate as all heck. I mean, it takes a long time to get to where you want. And there are certain things that will give you a step function increase. And then there's other things that will give you this very, very minimal increase that, you know, they work and they work well. But because of the fact that it takes so long to get customers, until you achieve this massive scale, those things are not going to measurably move the needle in very, very small time slices.
And that's why SaaS is so brutal, right? And that's why we talked about having small wins where you do the one-time software download, you do the WordPress plugin, or you do the mobile app, or maybe you do the info product or the training course, the ebook, because those things are things that you can kind of get out the door. They don't require a ton of support, and you can get early wins to build your confidence so that you can then later take the long slog of actually building the SaaS app, which, as we're finding more and more, it takes months, if not years, to really grow it, you know, into a sizable business.
You know, one of the things that Dan mentioned was that coverage in tech press doesn't work. And if you're looking for press coverage to get you customers, that's probably not going to help very well, but it will give your product and your website some validation. It'll give it some SEO juice. But I don't think that, you know, the traffic that you get in from those types of sources is going to convert into paying customers very quickly. I mean, it's great for those backlinks. It's great for the SEO. But in terms of getting targeted traffic, I mean, basically what you're ending up with is all all these people who are interested in new startups and new technologies, and they're going to come check it out and they may sign up, but they're not necessarily really interested. It's almost like saying, hey, come check out this tech demo, and you send it out to Reddit, and people are going to come and they're going to check it out, and you get this massive spike of traffic, but they're not going to stick around because that's not part of their job. It wasn't a problem they were trying to solve to begin with. They were just interested in something to use as a diversion for their daily life.
Yeah, remember when I got quoted in, was it the Wall Street Journal?
Yeah.
That resulted, as best as I can tell, because they didn't actually send a direct link, it was just a mention, but that resulted in right around 7 paying customers for Hittail.
That's awesome.
Which is a rounding error. I mean, it's completely inconsequential. And not saying that press doesn't work. I have heard of businesses. There was it was kind of like an iOS keyword tool, an analytics tool for the iOS App Store. And they got a mention on TechCrunch, and they got $25,000 in recurring revenue based on that mention. And that basically built their business. So yes, it can happen if your audience is heavily, heavily aligned with that press outfit. But I've heard several entrepreneurs talk about, and I'm the same way, talk about, well, I would rather be on Lifehacker, or for me, it's like, you know, the SEO Moz blog, than I would like to be in the New York Times, because those first two are just so much closer to my audience. It's like getting the small tech audience, and by small, you know, tens of thousands of people, is infinitely more valuable than getting, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions from the general public, basically, or the general press. And now Dan didn't get, you know, he wasn't on Good Morning America. He was on Mashable and The Next Web and This Week in Startups, Shoestring, and some other startup-related stuff. So they were reasonably targeted. They were at least in the tech space. And I don't know how many signups he got. I guess he said he has zero paid users. See, that's the problem, though. In the post, he said, I had zero paid users from those traffic sources. Now, if he was already launched, then you can tell that. But if you aren't launched, then you really want to know how many email addresses did you get? Because getting from that email to the paid customer then depends on your execution and your ability to close those sales. It doesn't depend on just the validation piece of it.
One of the things I really liked about Dan's blog post is that, you know, he showed some results from his targeted surveys, and he showed the number of people who had said, yes, I would pay for this, or no, or possibly pay for this. And then he showed percentages of how those things stacked up. And the one thing that struck me about this survey was that the numbers were all, I'll say, fairly low. I mean, there were less than 100 people who were surveyed as part of this. I don't think that going and asking 100 people or less than 100 people is a bad way to go. But I think that you also have to keep in mind that when you're asking less than 100 people and saying, would you pay for this, yes or no, people are going to tend to lean towards, oh, yes, I would pay for this, or a maybe. So if you start combining the yeses with the maybes, then you end up with this number that is, I'll say, artificially inflated, because the possibly or the maybes are, you know, you can't count them one way or the other. I mean, maybe you can split them down the middle, but still, you're just kind of guessing. And I feel like surveys should kind of guide your views and test some of your assumptions, but you also have to be very, very cautious about the conclusions you draw from some of these responses. If people are paying for it, then that helps out a little bit, because if they're paying for the product, then any new features that they're requesting, those are things that are going to keep them, versus people who are not paying for the product. You really need to find out what that problem solution fit is to get them and convert them into a paying customer. And testing some of those assumptions would be helpful, but you have to figure out exactly what the pain point is that you're solving. And I feel like that's what the survey should be for. And it looks to me like, I'll say the surveys were a little bit squishy in terms of what the surveys were asking.
Yeah, and for the record, this is when Dan pivoted from Informly, which was an analytics aggregator, and he pivoted into a content marketing analytics app. And I actually love this idea, to be honest, because we're doing content marketing with Hittail, and I'm working on it for Drip. And frankly, it is hard to track. Google Analytics does not do a very good job of that. So I would absolutely pay for something that was easy to set up and that worked. And, you know, when I look at Dan's kind of record of people who paid for it, you know, he said that 22%, which was like 17 people said that they would pay for it, and then only 3 people signed up, 1 canceled, and 2 weren't using it. Man, that's where you basically hit the pavement and you email every one of these people and say, why didn't you sign up? What doesn't it do? What kept you from doing it? Because I think that one was a winner. I really do. I mean, it's my personal opinion, so it's not worth very much, but I would pay for something that helped me do a better job of tracking content marketing than Google Analytics does. And so at that point, I wouldn't have stopped. I would have continued with the pursuit of emailing everyone, finding out if I, one, had not communicated the value proposition properly, meaning that the, you know, if I only got 3 signups out of this whole list, then perhaps my positioning or my descriptions, my headlines, you know, the value I was going to offer wasn't good enough, or the product itself wasn't good enough. It wasn't solving their problem yet. And then figure out what to do, what to iterate on in order to get to the point where I was solving one of those things. Personally, like I said, I think this is a problem worth solving, the content marketing analytics thing. And I don't know of a smaller, inexpensive SaaS app that does it. I'm sure there are, you know, $500 a month packages that do it, but there's no one in the startup space doing it.
So what are your thoughts on Dan's comments on about building the MVP and how he says that it's a lot harder than it sounds?
I think he has a valid point. He basically talks about how Eric Ries talks about building a minimum viable product and kind of talks about how that it's easy or implies that it's easy, or maybe just that has become to be known as, you know, getting an MVP out, you can do it in a weekend and then iterate on it. And that's the thing. If you take that very literally, then maybe you do release before it's a solid product. And maybe your failure on the product side is because you released too early. And so, yes, I actually think he has a very valid point here that it's very hard to know whether an MVP is good enough. To be honest, I think this is why you have to let a few people in at a time. And you have to find people who, when you talk about the single problem that you're going to solve, and there should only be one when you start, when you talk about that problem, it's the people whose eyes light up or who reply to your emails when you send them and they're really excited. And then you say, okay, Mr. Person Number One, I'm going to let you in and you're my first early access customer. Try the app. Does it suck? Is it good? Tell me what it needs to do. Then let person number two in once you've, you know, built all person number one's features. And to do this, it requires a lot of time, and it requires a lot of iteration, and it requires, you know, quite a bit of patience, as well as the ability to tell someone, you know, I'm not going to go in that direction, that I'm not going to build the features that you want, that you're not my ideal customer. So it's not as simple, like Dan says, it's not as simple as a lot of people, I think, expect this whole building the MVP and then iterating on it. It's not as simple as building up a big list, throwing everybody at it, and then iterating, because by that time, you've burned through your list now. You had a 2,000-person launch list, and you sent them all there, but if the product didn't solve the problem, then poof, you're done. Now you have to start over, and that's where I think really trickling it out very slowly, which is, you know, the way that I'm doing it with Drip right now. I mean, we, after a couple of months of basically having a fully functional MVP, we still only have 10 people active on the system because we want to build up those features that these people really need before letting in that next group.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, this is probably the most frustrating part about it. And I feel like Lean Startup, the book itself, really glosses over this fact that it's such an iterative process and it's time consuming. And that's the part that I think is so frustrating, is it's just so time consuming to work with individual customers in a way that in no way, shape, or form scales. And, you know, developers want to get, they're like, oh, well, the code is done, it works, let me just throw it out there. I mean, and I don't have to worry about bugs in the product. And maybe you don't. Maybe everything is functionally complete. But if it doesn't do what people expect or what they need it to do, then it doesn't really matter. And you need to somehow get through that process and take that step back and work through things slowly with people so that you make sure that you're solving the broader problems. And once you do, then you can throw it out there. But until you get to that point, it's very difficult to be able to do that because, as you said, you'll burn through your list very quickly, and then you've got to start over. To me, I think that that's probably the frustration that a lot of people find is when they try to build an MVP and they say, oh, well, it's working, let me throw it out there to people and try and get as many customers as I can as quickly as possible. It doesn't really work that way. And I don't think I've ever really seen it explained to say, hey, you know, you really need to work through this slowly as opposed to just throwing it out there.
Well, and I think in Dan's defense, that's the point he's raising, is that you read the Lean Startup book, you follow what kind of the Lean Startup movement and the folks are teaching, and it's very high level and it's academic. So they've never said the things we are saying right now on this podcast. They never say titrate it out. They never say build the MVP, have a few people use it, you know, exactly the steps we've just laid out, because a lot of them are not actively on the grounds developing products. And that's okay. It's not as tactical as it might need to be for someone like Dan, who isn't an experienced startup founder, who probably hasn't launched a startup like a software product before. When he reads something that is as high level as lean startup, he still needs much more detailed guidance. And frankly, I don't know where you go to get that. I mean, I think that's why we started the podcast. That's why we have the Academy. That's why we have MicroConf, is to try to provide that kind of education, not just in the lean startup space, but just in general for software founders who want more detailed, actionable, step-by-step stuff. And there's certainly, you know, courses out there on Udemy and that kind of stuff, but there's no real single place that I know of where you can say, all right, I read the lean startup. Now, how do I actually implement the lean startup? And I think Dan, you know, kind of took some hard knocks himself, basically learning that, right? He learned step by step that parts of the lean startup are harder than they might appear, harder than they were presented in the book. And I mean, I got to really thank Dan for putting this blog post together, for doing the experiments, for putting all the detail in here, and basically for raising the issue so that it, you know, so that we can discuss it intelligently on the podcast, because I think this raises a level of dialogue about the whole topic. You know, both of us, we want to thank Dan for putting this post together, for sure.
Yeah, definitely hats off to Dan. I mean, if you look at all the different things that have been written about the lean startup, I mean, there's all this stuff that says, oh, it's great, you do this, you do that, and everything's hunky-dory. And the reality of the situation is, once you start putting feet on the ground, it's not that simple. And it never is. I mean, when you're trying to go from a book to reality, there's a difference between theory and reality. So going through it and having I don't want to say it's an alternate point of view, but it's, you know, a lot of the things that Dan expressed, I mean, some of them are points that I share, and you know, some of them are frustrations that I share in looking at the lean startup, because it's not that simple. And it tries to portray it as being I don't want to say a step-by-step guide, but they're like, oh, well, you know, if you just do these things and pivot a little bit and take into account what your customers are saying or what your potential customers are saying and pivot, you know, as quickly as possible and iterate, you know, everything's fine. And it is just not that simple. And it just glosses over all of the details and all of the tactics that you actually need to execute on. And I feel like it's just too high level in many cases to be applicable to not all startups, because I think that there's definitely pieces of it that apply to very, very many of them, but it's just not tactical enough or provides you enough information to be able to decide when what you're doing is completely off the rails from what they recommend. But at the same time, that doesn't mean you're doing the wrong things. There's no hard guidelines in there for when you should listen to it and when you should ignore it.
Yeah, as I said at the start, you know, my views on lean are certainly evolving, and I think there's a lot of good that can come out of it, and there's some good high-level information. There's also that lack of detail you mentioned, and then there are some things that I do, you know, think are questionable or have not worked in my experience at all. So if you're interested in checking out Dan's app, it's at inform.ly, and he's basically pivoted into something that I think is he's now having success with, and it's beautiful client reports for freelancers and web agencies. So Informly connects to Google Analytics and other apps, and then it provides monthly reports that you can use as, you know, if you're a freelancer or web agency, to keep your clients happy. So we definitely wish Dan best of luck with this product moving forward. You know, we hope he continues to update us on his blog at thedannorris.com.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsforrestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.